Now, as a lot of you know, we are going through the book of Ruth, and the book of Ruth is this beautiful story about a woman, Naomi, about daughter-in-law, and about this man, Boaz, who it looks like he kind of comes to their rescue. And in chapter 4, we'll see, you know, what he does and how important he is to the story. But we're in chapter 3, and in chapter 3, it's this, I think for a lot of people, they read this, and it's kind of a love story. You know, it's interesting because I think as a culture, we have this obsession with love stories. You know, there are these classic love stories that we hear about all the time. There's, you know, Romeo and Juliet. There's like Pride and Prejudice. There's these kind of classic stories of people falling in love and coming together. There's, you know, I think most of you have seen like rom-coms like When Harry Met Sally or Sleepless in Seattle that are really popular because it's this love story. We have fairy tales that are built around that. You know, we find out that, you know, what will awaken the princess is a kiss from her true love, right? And then there are really bad kind of versions of it. There's those, you know, those Hallmark Halloween, you know, holiday movies. You know, those really cheesy movies about like a couple who's off skiing and, you know, they fall in love there. And, you know, there's always like holiday and faith and like other things tied into it. But, you know, the reason why I think a lot of these things are so popular is for some people, they love this idea of this romantic, spontaneous, this love of a lifetime idea, right? This idea that you meet the person that you are meant to spend the rest of your life with and that everything is magical. If you're married, you go, yeah, not everything's magical. It doesn't work out that way. There's not a lot of happily ever after endings to at that point. But as a culture, we want that. You know, we talk about like following your heart, not just in romantic things, but in everything in life. You know, follow your heart, follow your dreams, right? And in Ruth 3, what Ruth chapter 3 looks like is it looks like the Bible's version of a romantic movie, right? Here is Boaz, and he's this, you know, influential, wealthy person who has the means to be able to rescue them. And here is Ruth going in the middle of the night to secretly propose. And this, you know, kind of subverts what a lot of us expect. But we view it as this love story. And what I wanted to do today is Ruth chapter 3 is a love story, but it's a very different kind of love story. It doesn't follow kind of the patterns and the tropes that you're used to in most kind of rom-coms or in your classic love stories in your fairy tales. It is about love, but it is about a very different kind of love. And so that's what we're going to be exploring today. So as we go through Ruth chapter 3, we're going to see a couple things about love. First, we're going to see the weakness of love. Then we're going to see the strength of love. And then we're going to see what Ruth 3 really does point to, which is a greater love. There's kind of something else that's going on in the midst of this story. So first of all, the weakness of love. Like I mentioned, you know, chapter 3 is, to some degree, it is a love story, but it's not a romantic love story, right? This isn't about, like, romance. If we kind of, it's not this modern idea of love, this modern idea of romantic love where, you know, it's this emotion that overwhelms you and, you know, you see someone and you fall in love with them. If it was that way, you know, you could imagine the story would be, you know, that Boaz returned to his field. And to his surprise, he looked across a crowded field and he saw Ruth, right? And you can imagine all the trappings of this kind of romantic picture of Boaz falling in love with Ruth, Ruth falling in love with Boaz, them going and asking for the approval to be married, and then them celebrating their union together. And what we have here isn't that kind of picture. It isn't a picture of romantic love. It isn't a story about follow your heart. It isn't a story about any of those things. Right? Again, all those things sound beautiful, but when you think about it, those things are actually immature. Right? This modern notion that we have of love is actually this sense in which all we're doing is we're following our emotions. And the interesting part of our emotions are our emotions sway and dip and change all the time. Right? It's an incredible thing to, you know, if you're able to look at someone and say, oh, I love you, I want to spend the rest of my life with you, right? But at the same time, if it's just emotions, I mean, our emotions are always going up and down. Right? In a lot of ways, this idea of romantic love, this idea of love following your heart, sounds beautiful, but it's actually incredibly immature. There's no foundation, there's no direction to it. It's kind of like the love that kids have in a toy store, right? If you have kids, you take them into a toy store, and every single aisle, it's something else they love, right? You take them down one aisle, oh, I love that, can I get that? No, no, let's keep going. They see something, oh, I have to have this. You go down another aisle, please, this is what I want, right? It's different things all the time. And in a really kind of, in a very powerful way, I mean, that's what romantic love is if it's just emotions. If you actually look at chapter 3, no one acts purely on emotion. No one falls in love. Right, you go to verses 1 through 4, and in verses 1 through 4, it says this. It says, then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, my daughter, should I not seek rest for you that it may be well with you? Is not Boaz our relative with whose young women you were? See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Wash, therefore, and anoint yourself, and put on your cloak and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. But when he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do. When Ruth comes back, and when Naomi begins to give her this advice, she's not thinking about marriage at all. It's the furthest thing from her mind. You know, she doesn't come home going, oh, mother, guess who I saw today? Guess who I met? I saw the most wonderful man, right? She doesn't do that. She comes back and she explains where she was. She explains what happened. Her mother-in-law sees, you know, all the grain that she brought back, and she immediately launches into this instruction. She says, here's what I want you to do. And for Ruth, she's not thinking about a man. She's not thinking about marriage at all. For Ruth, her only concern at the moment is, how long is this food going to last us, right? Can I continue to care for my mother-in-law because we have nothing, right? The last thing on our mind is proposing and getting married. The proposal is Naomi's idea. And if you notice, it's not a romantic idea. Naomi has just heard of this man. She doesn't say, oh, you guys would be so cute together. That's so wonderful. I can't believe you guys met. She just says, oh, this is great. This will fix your problem. Right? There's, if anything, it's incredibly pragmatic. Right? What Naomi wants is she wants Ruth to get married because she knows that if she passes away, if Ruth is still by herself, she's going to have a very difficult life. Matter of fact, if you go back to chapter 1, if you remember, that's actually her advice. When Naomi's leaving, remember her two daughter-in-laws want to go with her, and she says, no, go back. If you go with me, you won't get married. I can't bear kids that you'll be able to get married to. You can't wait for them. You're not going to find someone there. And it makes sense because she's a foreigner, right? She's a foreigner going back to Bethlehem. She has no prospects. And yet here she says in a very pragmatic manner, she says, this is your chance to be taken care of, right? This isn't about romantic love. This is about pragmatism. Now, in addition, when you go to verses 12 and 13, we see the same picture kind of happening somewhere else. Verse 12 says, and now it is true that, this is Boaz, he says, he's speaking to Ruth. He says, now it is true that I am a redeemer, yet there is a redeemer nearer than I. Remain tonight, and in the morning, if he will redeem you, good, let him do that. But if he is not willing to redeem you, then as the Lord lives, I will redeem you. Lie down until the morning. Now, if you notice, Boaz isn't hopelessly in love either. Right? Like, she comes and she says, you know, she essentially kind of lays out this proposal. And if you notice what Boaz says, he says, there's actually someone else, and if he marries you, fine. Right? That's not romantic, right? You don't look at the person you fall in love with saying, hey, if someone else wants to marry you, that's fine, right? He looks at her and he says, there is another redeemer. You know, if he is interested, then he has to purchase the land and he has to marry you, and that's fine with me. Right? There's no pretenses of this romantic love on here. He's not obsessed with her. He's not in love with her. He's concerned for her. He's concerned for Naomi. And if you notice, it's a love story, but it's not that kind of love story. It's not two people falling in love madly and having to be together for the rest of their lives. And it's really good that it's not that type of story, because like I said, there is a problem with our idea of love. Right? The modern idea of love is this idea that is romantic and that is emotional, and the problem with that is always weak and that is always shallow. That type of love has no foundation, it has no strength, it has no direction, and it is always changing. Right? If love is something you fall into, then you can fall in love with someone, marry them, but you can fall in love with someone else. Right? That's the way it works. And so we see that there is a weakness to love. This isn't about love as we speak about it. The way we speak about love isn't very deep. It isn't very strong. There is no real foundation. Second thing we do see, though, is we do see the strength of love. We see what love is supposed to be. We see a different kind of love in the story, and I want you to see what that love looks like. We go back to verses 1 through 4. I won't read them again, but what Naomi does is she begins to give instruction to her daughter-in-law, Ruth. She says, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go over there in the dark, in the cover of dark. I want you to go to the threshing floor where he's going to stay, because he's going to work there. He's going to rest there. And when he lies down, I want you to lay down at his feet. And she kind of lays all this out. And what we see here is we see Naomi's love for her daughter-in-law, Ruth, right? Basically, what she's doing is she's giving Ruth instruction to go to this man and to essentially propose, to say, I'm willing to marry you, right? And as I mentioned, you know, there's a motivation for Naomi, right? You ask why. Why is she giving her this instruction? Why is she? And like I said, for Naomi, she wants to see Ruth remarry. Right? She wants to know that Ruth is taken care of. Again, you know, we're dealing with the ancient Near East, and at this time, for a woman not to be married or for a woman to be a widow essentially meant that they were going to be homeless, that they would have no means to support themselves, no means to care for themselves. If they didn't have any children, there was no children who were growing older who could then take them in, and that they would essentially be left to their own devices with no ability to take care of themselves. And so we see what love looks like. We see Naomi and her care for Ruth, that out of this concern, out of this love, she wants to ensure her future. Right? She wants to make sure that Ruth is taken care of. Now we see love somewhere else too. If you go to verses 5-7, in verse 5 it says, and she replied, this is Ruth. She replies to this instruction. She says, all that you say, I will do. So she went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law had commanded her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of a heap of grain. Then she came softly and uncovered his feet and lay down. Now, what we see here is we see Ruth's love for Naomi. Right? Again, Ruth isn't, as much as we want to pretend like this is this classic love story, this ancient love story, she's not in love. But she goes and does this, and she actually does it because she loves Naomi. She trusts Naomi, she loves her, and she knows that this is not only a way for her to be taken care of, it's a way for Naomi to be taken care of. When she first comes back, Naomi makes this comment that, oh, he's a close relative of ours. He's a kinsman redeemer. And so Naomi understands what that means. She understands that this man is someone who can not just help her in terms of marriage, but this is someone that if he redeems the land, then Naomi is safe too. That she now has the ability to make money, to take care of herself, to be able to provide for herself, and to not be destitute. And so what we see is actually Ruth is willing to marry someone that she's not necessarily in love with because she wants to care for and take care of Naomi. That's deep, right? We see the level of commitment, and we know from the story that Ruth has been committed to Naomi ever since they left Moab, right? That there was that moment where they were leaving, where they were outside of the skirts of town starting to travel, where Naomi said to Ruth, go home, live your life, do your thing, find someone else to marry, raise a family. And what Ruth says is she says, no, I will not leave you. Your God will be my God. Your people will be my people. Wherever you go, I will go. And what we see is this commitment continues on, that she is committed absolutely to take care of her, that she sees it as her responsibility, as her spiritual commitment, right, that Naomi is in her care. And then we see this other kind of picture of love. If you go down to verse 8, we read some of the tail end, but verse 8 it says, at midnight the man, which is Boaz, was startled and turned over, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. He says, who are you? He said, who are you? And she answered, I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer. And he said, may you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, in that you have not gone after younger men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do all that you ask, for all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman. And now I know it is true that I am a redeemer, yet there is a redeemer nearer than I. Remain tonight, and in the morning, if he will redeem you, good, let him do that. But if he is not willing to redeem you, then as the Lord lives, I will redeem you. Lie down until the morning. What we see Boaz act, and again, if we take it out of the context of this romantic love, we see Boaz make this decision that's going to completely uproot everything in his life. Right? He is a wealthy man, he's an influential man, but outside of his land and outside of the people who work for him, he has very little. Right? He's not married, he doesn't have children, and to make this decision to be the kinsman redeemer for Ruth and Naomi, he knows what that means. It means that he's going to have to spend a portion of his wealth to buy the land that belongs to Naomi to give it back to her. And he's also going to have to marry Ruth. And he knows that the way that the kinsman redeemer works is it's not just for land, it's also for lineage. So he knows that when he marries Naomi, when they have a child, the first one is not going to be his. The first one is actually going to belong to the line of Elimelech. And so essentially, he's being tasked with this responsibility to take care of, to build a family that is not going to be his own, at least for the first child. And so what he decides to do is he decides that he is willing to go through with that. Why? Well, the reason why is what we see in him is we see him make this decision to act as the kinsman redeemer for Ruth and Naomi because of his commitment to God, because of his love for God, that he understands his place in the community, his place in society, his place as far as the scriptures teach him about what a close relative can do and should do. And in that, he sees his responsibility to act the way in which God has called him to act, to be someone who can restore the land back to the hands that it belongs to, and to continue the line through this marriage for someone else that's not for him. And in each portion, what I want you to know is each person acts out of love, but it's a very different kind of love. It's not a romantic type of love. For each of them, their love is rooted in their commitments and their responsibilities. Right? For each of them, what matters to them, what makes them love, is their commitment, their decisions, their responsibilities. For Naomi acts because she is concerned and she cares for Ruth as her mother-in-law, and she wants to see what's best for her. For Ruth, she loves Naomi and she acts as her caretaker. For Boaz, he agrees to be the kinsman redeemer as stipulated in Israel's law because this is the way God has put society together. You see, here's what I want you to notice. Modern love is weak. It comes and it goes. Right? Modern love is simply whenever you feel like it. You feel like loving someone, you feel like not loving someone. And that goes beyond our marriages. That goes into every part of our life. You go into to work sometimes and you get up on the wrong side of the bed and you don't want to talk to anyone. Right? You don't want to be nice to anyone. You don't want to extend yourself even to someone who's, especially people who are difficult. Right? Like the way we do love, love comes and goes. Kindness comes and goes. It's just wherever we are in our emotions. Wherever we are that day, whether the coffee's been good, whether the coffee's not been good, whether we've gotten up on the right side of the bed or the wrong side of the bed, or whatever's happening in our lives. Our decisions of love are based just on our emotions and the sways and the changes that happen with it. There's no foundation, there's no direction. But what we see here is biblical love is different. It's a love that's rooted in commitment, a love that is rooted in responsibility. And because of that, it has a foundation and it has a purpose. See, Ruth was committed to Naomi. And because of that, she was willing to sacrifice her marital happiness. Knew nothing about this man, nothing about whether he's abusive, whether he was kind, whether he was, knew very little about him, and she was willing to put herself into the marriage for Naomi's sake. What we see is Naomi is committed to Ruth. We see Boaz is committed to God. And because of that, they all make these decisions. And what it actually allows them to do, which is really, really unique, is it allows them to make difficult decisions. It allows them to make sacrificial decisions. It allows them to do things and to say things and to decide things for their lives that were uncomfortable, that wouldn't benefit themselves. And that's the picture of love that we get here. Not a romantic love where everything is easy, where the story ends with a happily ever after, but a love that is rooted in the commitments and responsibilities that we take on before God, the commitments and responsibilities that we take on as a community. And when we make those decisions, sometimes love leads us into sacrifice. Sometimes love leads us into difficulty. Sometimes love leads us into hard situations. But in the midst of those things, because there's a commitment, because there's a purpose behind it, we become willing to sacrifice, willing to do things that are better for others and not for us, willing to put ourselves out so that others are put up, right? And so we see something very, very different. This is a love that's connected to their faith, and as a result, they live their lives in a way that's faithful, right? They live their lives in a way that's not for themselves, but that's for God and for other people. And in our kind of understanding of what love is, like sometimes that doesn't sound that great, right? Love doesn't, in some way, this idea of love tied into commitment and responsibility doesn't sound great. We believe that there's something very special about a love that's impulsive, or a love that is like passionate, or a love that's emotional, a love that is, genuine in those ways. And we view like the other kind of love as like silly, as like really, really like not love, right? Responsibility. C.S. Lewis says this about love, and I think he puts it well. He says, love is not affectionate feeling. He says, love is not affectionate feeling, but a steady wish. He says, this is what it is. It's a steady wish for the loved person's ultimate good as far as it can be obtained. And he says, love is not an affectionate feeling, but a steady wish for the loved person's ultimate good as far as it can be attained. And you see, that's the picture that we're getting here. We're getting this picture of a love that isn't passion and emotion and this is what I want, so I have to have it. It's a love that looks at another and says, this is what's good for you, so I will give it. And in a lot of ways, that's the only way you can love. That's a kind of love that is actually transformational. Anyone can love and say, I want it. Anyone can love in a way that says, I have to have it. But a love that is transformational is a love that makes you say, I don't want it, but you need it, and I will give it. That's actually a love that changes you, right? It doesn't change you to be selfish. It doesn't change you to simply follow your heart. It doesn't change you to simply do the things that you want to do, to love the people that you want to love them in the way that you want to love them. That doesn't change you at all. And if anything, it makes you more self-centered, more selfish. The love that changes you is the love that we see here, a love that says, this isn't best for me, but it is good for you, and I will do it. That's a love that changes you. It turns you inside out. It builds a foundation in your life, and it gives you a direction for your life. And that's exactly what happens in Ruth chapter 3, is each of them are transformed through these decisions to love each other. Here's kind of what it means to us. It means that if you're a Christian, right, if you're here today and you believe in Jesus Christ, he's your Lord and he's your Savior, it means you and I, because of our love for Christ, because of our commitment to him, I think it means that you and I have this incredible capacity and ability to love in a way that will transform people's lives. Right? If you're not a Christian, love simply works as kind of like birthday gift. Right? You give something to someone, they have to give it back to you. And if they don't give it back to you, they're not getting a gift next time, right? It's always a trade. Love isn't meant to be a trade. It isn't meant to be payback, right? It isn't meant to be tit for tat. It isn't, I do this for you, you do this for me. Right? If you're a Christian, you and I have this incredible capacity to be selfless. You and I have this incredible capacity to be sacrificial. You and I have this incredible capacity to go out in the world and to be servants, to be givers and not takers. And that's one of the things that I think that will change the world. All right, Jesus said this, and it's one of those things he says that sounds like such a simple thing, but he says, love your neighbor as yourself. That's actually one of the most radical things, one of those spiritual things you can ever do. If you're a Christian, you have a capacity to be a better spouse, to be a better father or mother, to be a better coworker, to be a better friend, to be a better neighbor, right? To be a better anything, because you have a deeper, stronger capacity to love people. And when people see that kind of love coming from you, not only does it transform you, it transforms them. It changes their lives. Now, the third thing we have to ask is, where does this come from? And it actually comes, what we actually see in chapter 3 is we see that there is a greater love. There is a reason why all this is happening. There is something that we can point to and say, this is what we stand on. If you go to verse 10, there's this really kind of interesting line that's in here that we have to pull apart, but it says in the middle of this whole thing where Ruth has gone and she's laid by Boaz, and Boaz has woken up and he's kind of said this. He says this in verse 10. It says, may you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, in that you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. Now, what's really interesting is there's a word used in there, and it's a very important word for the entire book. We've talked about it before, but it's this word hesed. Hesed's this Hebrew word which is usually used for God, and what it means is this steadfast love, right? This committed love. And when it's used of God, it's used in a way that we're told that God shows hesed to his people. And what that means is it means that it's not this idea of romantic love. It's this idea that God has made a covenant with his people. And based on that covenant, God acts accordingly. Right? God acts in this responsible, committed manner that he chooses to do loving things because he is committed to do loving things, because he is committed to be a part of these people, that these are his people. And so we have this really special word that's used, and it's typically used of God. It's actually a word that comes all throughout Ruth. It hits three times. It comes up in chapter 1. Ruth says something along the lines of, May God bless you. And she mentions this hesed. It comes up in chapter 2. She says the same thing. She says recognizing God's hesed in what is happening. In chapter 3, you know, so this is a word that drives the entire narrative, the entire story of everything that's happening in this story. In chapter 10, it's used again. And what's really interesting to me is it's not used of God. It's actually used of Ruth. In verse 10, if you notice, he says, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first." That phrase, last kindness, is actually this idea of hesed. And if you notice, here's what he's saying. He's saying, you've shown me, not romantic love, he says, you've shown me covenant love. You've shown me this love that is based on commitment, right? You've committed yourself to God. You've committed yourself to Naomi, and you are now acting out of that. And this is what he says after that. He says, you have made this last kindness greater than the first, in that you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. Now, here's basically what he's saying, is he's saying that if you take a look at Ruth's love, her steadfastness, her faithfulness, this hesed, it's actually seen in her willingness to not put her personal preferences for younger men, more handsome men, more wealthy men, before her commitment to her new family, to Naomi. In other words, Ruth does something. She's kind of the focal point of chapter 3. Boaz is the focal point of chapter 4. But in chapter 3, we actually see through her, we see a greater love. We see a woman who is willing to lay down all her personal preferences, all the things that might be better for her, because she has made a decision that she is going to care for her mother-in-law. And based on that decision, she's going to live her life out, even if that means sacrifice, even if that means something she doesn't want, even if that means difficulty. And she makes that decision. And Boaz recognizes it. He says, may the Lord bless you because you've shown this to me. I'm not a young man. I am not a handsome man. I am not a rich man like some others. But instead, you choose to come and you've chosen me. And you see, in that act, what we see is we see a greater love. We see the kind of love that can make us love like that. See, what the gospel is about is the gospel is not about God looking down at the earth saying, hey, you look like you could do a lot of things for me. Hey, you look really intelligent. I could use that. You look really gifted. That would be great to have in the church. And what we actually find out is that Paul tells us that's not how God chooses people. God doesn't choose, you know, the intelligent. He doesn't choose the wealthy. He doesn't choose the powerful. He chooses the foolish. You know, what we find out, what hesed is that God chooses the weak of the world, and when he chooses them, he will never not stand by their side. He will never stop loving them. And, you know, that's a love that will change your life. Ruth chapter 3 is a love story, but it's not about Boaz and Ruth. It's not about Ruth and Naomi. It's a story, it's a reminder of an ancient love story, of God's love for you. That just as Naomi goes and has very little to look for in Boaz, God looks at us, and even though we have very little to offer, he chooses us. I think when you understand that that's the love story being told, it means so much more. This isn't just two people thrown together by whim or thrown together by providence. Right? This is a picture of the love that you and I have from God, a love that is not based on anything that we are, anything that we can be, anything that we ever will be. But it's because we have a God who is rich in mercy, abounding in love, and he's willing to love even the foolish because there are better out there. You know, the last thing I wanted to end with is this. What we actually see in that picture too is that God's decision to love us isn't just this idea of God being steadfast and God being faithful through our lives. What we also realize is that just like it is for Naomi, just like it is for Ruth, just like it is for Boaz, you know, like I said, for Boaz, in order to do the things that God wants him to do, in order to love the way God has called him to, he needs to give up a good portion of his wealth. He needs to buy this property. He also needs to give up his life. And he can't be a bachelor anymore, no more doing whatever he wants. And when he has kids, they're not even going to be his. You know, what we see is that God's love for us isn't just steadfast and faithful. It also leads to him being sacrificial. It leads to him taking a cost. You know, what we know that Ruth and Naomi and Boaz don't know is that someone else is going to come, right? Jesus is on the way. And when Jesus comes, he will show us through his life, through his death, through his resurrection, that his steadfast, faithful love for his people will be sacrificial, that it will cost him. Right, for Jesus, his love for us means that he has to go to the cross. His love for us means that he has to give up his life. His love for us means that he will have to endure the shame and that he will have to be rejected by the Father, that he will have to experience condemnation. And you know, when you really understand that, when you understand that there's this great sacrifice, this huge cost, you could say, well, I guess, I mean, he did what he had to do. But Hebrews 12 actually goes further. It says, tells us about Jesus, it says, for the joy set before him, he endured the cross, despising its shame, is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. God's love for you didn't just lead him to sacrifice and cost. You have a God that was glad to pay the price, who was glad to take the cost. And you see, when you've been loved like that, when you know that that's the love he's had for you, then that's a love that you can begin to give to other people, that you can begin to become sacrificial, that you can begin to bear a cost in the way that you treat people, and that it can give you this incredible capacity, not just to love, but to be changed by love and to change people by love. As we go into communion reminds us of the fact that Jesus' love is costly. You know, when we look up at the bread and the wine, it is all about what Jesus paid for us. The bread reminds us that his body was broken. The wine reminds us that his blood was shed. And all of this he did because he loves us. What we have at the table isn't a begrudging sacrifice. It isn't Jesus saying, I guess this is my lot. I guess this is what I have to do. You know, Hebrews 12 says, with joy he endured the cross. Right? With joy he endured the suffering and the shame. And so as we come, let's come with joy, knowing that Jesus laid all this out for us in his joy. Let's take a moment, and I want to encourage you just in prayer, meditation, to reflect on what Jesus has done for you. Hopefully that leads you to wanting to be more loving, more compassionate, understand that you have this other capacity to care for people and to be loving in their lives. But let's take a moment and let's meditate on the love that we have in him. Let's pray. Father, we do have in Jesus Christ, we have a love that we do not deserve, a love that we cannot earn, a love that transforms us. And we want to remember that through this meal, that what we have is not just a generic love for God that flows to people, but a love that comes through cost, one that is given through sacrifice, but one in which you understood what it would take to love us. And yet, you were not just willing, but you were joyful to do it. So, Father, as we take in the bread and the wine, Lord, may we understand your love better for us. And may we be more committed to going out and loving. So Father, use this meal as our spiritual substance to fill us and energize us for everything that you put in front of us. We pray this in Jesus' name, amen. I'm gonna ask if Justin can come up and we're gonna be serving communion together. As we normally do, we'll ask if you can come down through the center aisle. We'll have two lines, one on the right side, one on the left side. You can come up to the altar and take, and then work your way back around to your seats. When you get back to your seat, if there's a little bit of time, meditate, pray, and then we'll take the bread, we'll take the wine together. Again, you know, if you're here kind of visiting us today and you're not a believer, you know that spiritually there's a lot of things you still aren't sure about, you need to figure out, you haven't decided on, then we do ask you to observe. But for the rest of us, as we take, let's take with a desire to know better what Christ has done for us. So as we get ready, we'll invite you to come, to take, to remember.